Thank you, Mr. Clevenger, and good afternoon, everyone. Certainly want to wish everyone a happy Sabbath, certainly those who are joining us on the Cybercast, as well as those who are here with us today. Ahead of time, I spoke with Mr. Deemer, who's bringing the second message, and he said he's got plenty of material to go almost a full sermon length, and I said, well, that's fine. I'll try to go a little bit shorter on my piece. So you folks are going to be in for a good dose there with a little bit less of me and hopefully a little bit more of Mr. Deemer. Folks who know me well know that from the time I was just a little guy, my life's dream was to be a cowboy. And that was a dream that came true for me because one summer before I finished college, I spent cowboying on a Wyoming cattle ranch. And I did the things that cowboys did. I rode a horse. I branded calves. I mended fence. I also encountered some things that I hadn't anticipated. And one of those was coming face to face with the game of polo. The ranch owner had an avid passion for playing polo. And I guess it made sense because, after all, he had the money, he had the horses, he had the land. I never got to spend much time around any of the polo players, but one afternoon I took some time away from my duties for just a little while because the rancher and his team were together down on the polo field, and visitors had come by to watch the game. We were out actually in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and so there were a lot of tourists. And so they kind of flocked to the ranch once in a while to watch these games. And so there was I, also watching. And what I remember most was the rancher and some of his playmates, some of his colleagues, talking and explaining the game and the intricacies about it, because I knew nothing about it whatsoever. I mean, basically, all the players are mounted. They're on horseback on these polo ponies. They each have a mallet in hand with which they try to hit the ball to, you know, score points and win ultimately. But the statement that this rancher made that just seemed so unusual to me, he said, the game is very fast-paced because at times, you know, you can be headed down the field in this direction chasing that ball and someone comes in from the side and whacks the ball in the opposite direction. And he said, it's very easy to lose sight of the ball and to be there thinking, now where is that ball? Where did it go? I knew it was here, but I don't see it. And suddenly, he said, your pony will bolt to one side or the other. And you think, well, what's he doing? And then he stops. You look down on the ground, and there's the ball. He said, you see, the thing is, these ponies are smart. They understand the game. They know what their job is. And that job is to get their rider to the ball. He said, so when that happens, when you look down and see that ball, you just think, well, thanks, old girl. And you hit the ball and hopefully win the game. Well, I was recently reminded of this when I was speaking with another member of God's church. And this individual commented to me, have you ever noticed that sometimes you meet people who just really seem to be on top of everything? Their life is organized. They have a plan. It's step A to step B to step C. And they're on top of everything. And they really know where they're going and how to get there. And then other times, you encounter people who seem to be exactly the opposite. And this is both in the church and out of the church. People that just seem to be a victim of circumstance, that they're not on top of things, they're just chasing full blast, trying to keep up with life. And sadly, sometimes, that's us too. We've all had days like that, I think, when we just really don't understand, you know, well, what's going on here? I thought I had a plan, but I'm just so far off base now. Well, I know I have had days like that too. And I'm sure you have as well. Sometimes a person like that who's not in control of everything still finds himself suddenly, like that polo player, looking down on the ground and thinking, well, there's the ball. I was chasing the ball that direction, but I lost it, and now my pony has brought me here, that it's right here at my feet. And so, yes, I hit the ball. I won the game. But I sure didn't realize it at the time, and it wasn't because of any great prowess on my part that I knew the beginning to the end. No, it wasn't like that. I just feel like I was a victim of circumstance, and yet it all worked out wonderfully. I know that happens to us sometimes. It happens to God's people. And I'm curious if any of you have ever felt that way. And today, I'd like for us to look at an account in God's Word that tells us of someone else who was very much in the situation I described and very much scored the winning touchdown, so to speak. Turn with me, please, to the book of Esther. And we're going to review her account, which I believe very much falls within the parameters I have just described. The book of Esther, chapter 1. Esther is not a long book, but as I told you, I want to make sure I save plenty of time for Mr. Deemer, so we're not going to read it all. We're just going to kind of hit some highlights and paraphrase a few things. But starting in chapter 1 of Esther, verse 3, in the third year of his reign, and this is King Ahasuerus of Persia, he made a feast for all his officials and servants, the powers of Persia and Media, the nobles, the princes of the provinces being before him. So he holds a feast. This is the king. Now, just to keep your bearings here, remember, Judah has gone into captivity years ago, carried away by Nebuchadnezzar to Babylon. Well, now Babylon has fallen to Persia, and now we're in the Persian Empire. Skipping ahead here to about verse 10. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded, and he lists quite a few names here, these are all eunuchs who served in his presence, to bring Queen Vashti before the king wearing her royal crown in order to show her beauty to the people and the officials, for she was beautiful to behold. So he wants to parade his wife, the queen, and show off a little bit to all his friends, all the nobles, to say, here is the queen. What a beauty she is. But what happens in verse 12? Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command, brought by the eunuchs. Therefore the king was furious, and his anger burned within him. He was outraged. His wife is standing him up. I mean, he's not just some boy going to the prom to get stood up for a date. His wife would not come forward for everyone to behold. Well, he's livid. And so he discusses this with all his nobles. What are we going to do? And they all say, well, king, you need to do something serious. Because if you don't do like Barney Fife always said on the Andy Griffith Show and nip this in the bud, who knows where it's going to end? I mean, we could have the ERA and Women's Lib and it could be all these problems. Maybe his nobles were able to look forward a few thousand years to see where we might be in the 20th century here in America. And they said, no, you've got to do something serious about this. And so in verse 19, we read, if it pleases the king, let a royal decree go out from him, and let it be recorded in the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it will not be altered, that Vashti, the queen, shall no more come before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she, one who will come at her husband's request. So he replaces her. Well, I think you all know the story. What happens? they send out the word, bring all the beautiful young maidens before the king, that he can choose a new queen. And in chapter 2, verse 17, we read, "The king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight, more than all the virgins. So let the royal crown upon her head, and made her queen instead of Vashti." He set the crown on her head. She would be the new queen. And we skipped ahead here. Esther is one of the Jews. She's one of those who have been carried into the kingdom here from Judah, taken captive years ago. There's two other principal players in the story whom we need to name at this point. The first is Mordecai. He's a good guy. Chapter 7 here, still in chapter 2. Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. She was an orphan. Her parents were gone now. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. And when her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So basically, he adopted her, he raised her, and now here she's become the queen. Here she has become the queen, but Mordecai would still be the closest thing to a father, an uncle, that she ever had. I said we have another character to introduce into the story, and that's Haman. Unlike Mordecai, he's not a good guy. He's a bad guy. In chapter 3, verse 1, "After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him." So basically, Haman's right at the top of the government, right beneath the king. You might think of him as the prime minister or a position like that. Very high-ranking official. Continuing here in verses 2 through 6, "And all the king's servants who were within the king's gate bowed and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai would not pay homage." He'd say, "No, I'm not going to bow down to you. I bow to the Lord." He was a faithful Jew. And so he would not bow to Haman. And again, skipping forward here through the next few verses, Haman is just furious. And he thinks, "What can I do about this Jew who will not bow to me?" And he thinks, "I can't just have him put to death because that would look bad. I have a better plan." And so he concocts this scheme whereby he's going to have all the Jews exterminated. He's going to have them all put to death. And he goes to the king and he says, "Oh, king, there is a group of people in your empire here who don't pay homage. They don't respect your authority, your kingship. And so therefore we need to have them all put to death." And the king basically says, "Well, yeah, that makes sense." And so he signs it, puts his signet on it, and says, "Make it so. Carry out the thing which I've just approved." He's approved the plot. And of course, Haman is thinking, "Ah, this is great. At last I'm going to get rid of these people who don't pay homage to me." And that's what happens here. And that goes up through about verse 11. "And the king had set his signet on it, so it couldn't be reversed. This was a done deal." If we move forward now into chapter 4, we read how this news was received by Mordecai. "When Mordecai learned all that had happened, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the midst of the city. He cried out with a loud and bitter cry. He went as far as the square in front of the king's gate, for no one might enter the king's gate clothed with sackcloth." So basically, he's mourning. He's saying, "This is terrible. Our people, God's people, are going to be killed. And it's coming from the highest office in the land. What can we do? And skipping ahead here, in verse 4, Esther's maids and eunuchs came and told her, the queen. She was deeply distressed. So she sent garments to clothe Mordecai and to remove his sackcloth. But he would not accept them. He said, no, I'm in mourning. I'm not about to remove this sackcloth. Then Esther called Hakoth, one of the king's eunuchs, whom he had appointed to attend her, and she gave him a command concerning Mordecai to learn what and why this was. She said, find out why Mordecai is so upset and so bereaved. So Hakoth went to Mordecai in the city square that was in front of the king's gate, and Mordecai told him all that had happened. And the fact that Haman had even received money, money was promised to be given into the king's treasury as a result of this extermination of the Jews. He tells Esther everything about this. He explained it all to her. And then he went back to Esther and told her the story. Well, Esther is also quite upset. And in verse 10, Esther spoke to Hathach and gave him a command for Mordecai. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court to the king who has not been called, he has but one law: put all to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter, then he may live. She says, it's death to go before the king uninvited. But then she says to Mordecai, I know you think I can just waltz in there because I'm the queen, but it isn't that way. You need to understand, Mordecai, the end of verse 11, I myself have not been called to go into the king these 30 days. Yeah, I know. He made a big fuss about getting a new queen. He loved me more than everyone else, but he hasn't summoned me in the last month. So the eunuchs, they go and they tell Mordecai all the words that Esther had spoken. She says, I'm not invited. I don't have an invitation. Now finally, we come to verse 13. This is the good part. If you've been dozing up until now, well, wake up, because this is the part that's going to make the sermon today. Then Mordecai told them to answer Esther, do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. Just because you're the queen, you're not going to escape. The truth will find you. And in verse 14, he spoke these cutting words, for if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Mordecai told her, don't expect that you're going to escape if you just are quiet and don't say anything about this. And Mordecai said, deliverance for the Jews will arise from another source, if not from you. Mordecai was positive of that. There was no question in his words. He didn't say, well, perhaps. He didn't say, well, maybe it'll work that way. He said, definitely, deliverance for the Jews, God's people, will come. How could he be so confident and certain? Again, remember the time setting here. We're in Persia. Think about all the prophets who have spoken in years past, men like Isaiah. Mordecai would be aware of their words. He knew the Messiah for which they all waited, was to come from the Jews, as we know Jesus Christ did. So he had no doubt God was going to protect his people. He had no doubt. But there was something about which he was not so certain. Those two little words that he said in the last part of verse 14, "Who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" In other words, he admitted, "I don't know, Esther, and frankly, you don't either. You don't either. But maybe, perhaps, that's why God has brought you into this position that you occupy today, so that you can deliver your people." Well, consider for a moment, this plan concocted by Haman, it came from the very top. Haman was right up here, right under the king. Who else was there who could somehow go over his head? The one person might have been the queen who would have the king's ear. And so, Mordecai said, "Perhaps you have come here for exactly this purpose." God could have delivered the Jews in any way, and Mordecai knew that. Nothing's too hard for God. He parted the waters of the Red Sea. So Mordecai wasn't concerned that God wouldn't be able to do it without Esther's help, but he knew that it was a possibility that God specifically had brought events around this way so that Esther would be able to be used. He recognized that mankind's view was limited. His view was limited, but that did not limit God in any way. And Esther, being in a unique position to take action, she did so. That's exactly what she did. Because Mordecai basically told her, "Look down at your pony's feet. You know what you're going to see? There's the ball. Hit the ball, Esther." And she did, very powerfully. Because in Esther 4, verses 15 and 16, we read exactly what she did. "Then Esther told them to return this answer to Mordecai, 'Go gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan, fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise. And so I will go to the king, which is against the law, and if I perish, I perish.'" Did you notice the very first thing Esther said she would do? She would fast. She asked others, her people, to fast for her too. She wanted to draw close to God. She knew this was serious. She said, "Mordecai, if we're going to come through this alive, we need God. So fast for me." And then in the following chapters, 5, 6, and 7, we're told exactly what Esther did. She planned a series of banquets for the king. During these coming days, Mordecai is honored, promoted. But Haman is humbled, and ultimately, he's executed, hanged on the very gallows that he had prepared for none others than Mordecai. The Jews are all saved. Well, I like this story. I don't know about you, but I do, because it has a happy ending. I like it when everything comes together and the good guy wins. But it also has, I believe, some important lessons for us. The first one, God does not always reveal to his people all the details behind what he's doing in their lives, as well as the lives of others. God doesn't always tell us. He doesn't reveal to his people all the details behind what he's doing. Remember Mordecai's telltale words. Who knows? Who knows? If we turn over to 1 Peter for just a minute, 1 Peter 4, verse 12, Peter makes an interesting comment here. "Beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened to you." In other words, he's encouraging us, don't think, why has this befallen me? I don't understand. I'm so confused. Why would something like this happen to me? God does not necessarily tell us in advance the details of these things when they'll come upon us. We know trials will come, but it's rare that we know exactly when and how. It's important for us to remember, God just hasn't told us these things. The second thing I think we can learn from Esther's story is exactly what she did. She sought to draw close to God. She said, "Fast for me, fast with me." She knew that was important. Undoubtedly, she was praying. They were all praying fervently and earnestly. And you know, that's really nothing new for God's people, is it? Isn't that what we're encouraged to do again and again? When we're in dire straits, isn't that when we really need to draw close to God? We may not always have time to fast. I mean, if I show up at work 8 o'clock Monday morning and I'm told, "Scott, the boss wants to see you at 9, I probably don't have time to fast, because if I've eaten a big breakfast, I probably wouldn't even have a coffee break until 9 o'clock anyway, but I can sure be praying and seeking to be close to God. That's what Esther did, and that's what we need to do. And finally, point number 3. Always remember, even when we are not on top of a situation, God is. Even when we're not on top of things, God is. Remember the words that Mordecai basically spoke to Esther. "Hit the ball, Esther. You just might hit a home run. Maybe you'll have a hole in one or the game point. Do it, Esther." Philippians 4, verse 13. I think Paul gives us some insight here. Philippians 4, verse 13. So often when we're not up on top of our game, we might think, "Well, I'm not really very adept at doing something. I'm not really very well prepared to do what you're asking me to do. I don't feel that I'm very qualified to do that." And here the Apostle Paul tells us, "I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." Notice, he didn't say, "I can do some things, I can do most things." "I can do all things through Christ." And finally, back in Romans chapter 8, verse 28. Romans 8, verse 28. Some more words concerning all things. "Now we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to His purpose." Right here is the secret behind Esther's actions. Mordecai must have known this, that all things are going to work out for the best. And indeed, they did. I believe that these are precious promises that God makes to His children. If we begin to recognize when we don't know all the details, because many times we don't, if it's then that we'll draw close to God, and remember that God always does know the details. He's always in charge. He's always the one that knows the beginning from the end, that can help us in time of need. If we can do that and remember these things from Esther, then we can step forward in faith and confidence, look down, and hit that ball.